Couch Potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Voyagers, Thunder Force, The Power, Them, and The Last Cruise. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring News of the World. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The big piece of news that happened this week, which really happened over last weekend, was the unprecedented success of Godzilla vs. Kong in theaters. Now, we already knew that was a crowd pleaser in theaters, mainly because it had a huge international box office leading up to its domestic release. But the thing that Warner Brothers loved was the fact that it played like gangbusters in theaters last weekend, as well as doing quite well on HBO Max. Now, you got to realize you can't divorce the two completely. It was a success on both. It was watched a lot by people at home on HBO Max, and it was also seen in theaters with people buying tickets. To the tune of one of the best openings since the pandemic really took hold. And now its weekend total was 32 million. It's not quite at pre-pandemic numbers for as big of a success, but that's really good. I mean, some of these movies that released have made 32 million total, and that was considered good throughout the pandemic. But when you take into the fact that it opened on Wednesday, it ended up with $48.5 million for its five-day domestic opening, which is huge. This is what they wanted with Tenet last year. And I think there's a couple reasons for it. One of the things was when Tenet came out back in September, there was still a lot of questions about whether the theaters were safe and the virus was still spreading. We were on a huge uptick in infections going into the fall, and there were still some unanswered questions, and there was no vaccines around. Now, coming into the Godzilla weekend, pretty much we've had theaters open for 6 months to the tune of most of the theaters in the country and then the ones in New York and LA recently, but there haven't been any major super spreader events tied to a theater. You know, we find these super spreader events, you know, like a wedding or a church service or a prison or something like that, and we find these events that infect a lot of people. You haven't had that showing up on the news with the theater, so I think people are a little more comfortable going to the theaters, plus theaters are still practicing the social distancing and there's mask rules and they're still playing at limited capacity. They're not at packed houses yet. And that's great for Godzilla vs. Kong. I think that's wonderful. One of the things that has happened though with this news is immediately, and I remember seeing this news on Sunday, everyone's like, theaters are back. The theatrical experience survives. And I'm like, okay, let's pump the brakes a little bit because this is one movie. I did not say theaters were dead when Tenet bombed, and I'm not ready to say that theaters are back 100% now. I think that we're still in a changing pattern. Now, with this news, Warner Brothers is sort of emboldened, and they've come out and said that they're going to be going to theatrical windows, and they're going for a 45-day theatrical window, which is shorter than the normal 90-day. They're following the pattern that some other studios have done, where they're saying, okay, we'll put it in for 45 days, and then we're going to put it on our streaming services. And they're talking about doing that for the 2022 releases. But they're even sort of hedging the language on that. They're basically saying tentpole releases. Essentially, as I read these news stories about Warner Brothers releasing movies next year, they're saying that the huge movies, the tentpole releases, you know, the 9 or 10 that any studio does over the course of a year, those are going to get theatrical distribution exclusivity. But who knows? I mean, smaller movies, like, and I use the example of somebody I was talking to, you know, like Judas and the Black Messiah. That was a movie from Warner Brothers, and that went to HBO Max at the same time it went to theaters. I don't necessarily think that's a crowd-pleasing, big-screen movie. I think you get the same thing out of it watching it at home on your television set than you would something like Godzilla, which is, you know, that's a big-screen movie. So don't read too much into this. They may still be looking at a hybrid model for release. And certainly with companies like Disney, which is aggressively trying to figure out a way to do the theaters and Disney Plus selections, and whether or not people pay a premium for it, they're testing the waters. They are still testing this. And you got to remember, it's only April. Whole lot can change in 8 months. You will lose subscribers on HBO Max if you are not dropping the big releases in the service as well, especially at the tune of how expensive HBO Max is compared to, you know, the Disney service, which is about half that price. So, you know, let's not get too eager for it. Now, the other thing that's interesting, another piece of distribution news, is Sony has announced that it had made a deal with Netflix as essentially their first right of refusal to stream their content, their new movies. So like when they drop the new Spider-Man movies, those are going to go exclusively to Netflix. And Netflix, I'm assuming, paid big bucks. I had heard up to $1 billion for this right. And that makes it look like Sony is saying, we're not going to bother to put up our own service. We'll just broker a deal with Netflix, and then Netflix gets our stuff, and we don't have to worry about paving our own way into the marketplace that's already crowded with HBO Max and Disney Plus and Paramount Plus and Peacock and all these other different services. So this stuff is not resolved yet. I mean, you got to remember, we're still in a surge of the coronavirus. And even though some numbers are going down, some are going up, people are getting vaccinated. But, you know, we're looking at 25-30% of the population is vaccinated. We still have a long way to go until we're at herd immunity. So I think these theatrical plans are going to change constantly. Because remember, the HBO Max / theater version only is 4 months old. It started in December with Wonder Woman. So a lot of stuff can change between now and January of 2022. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to hit is Those Who Wish Me Dead, starring Angelina Jolie. It's in theaters and on HBO Max on May 16th.
I'm not gonna hurt you.
I want to see where the blood's coming from.
It's not my blood.
You in trouble? Anyone else in trouble?
My dad said if anything happened, I should find someone I could trust. Are you someone I can trust?
Jump back into movies for Angelina Jolie, going back into the action category where she's trying to save a kid who's being chased by hitmen. This looks like a standard protect the kid movie. Now, going back to what I'd said earlier about theatrical releases, yeah, it's going to have some cool special effects because it involves forest fires and some pretty cool scenery. But again, is this going to be the big screen movie that Godzilla versus Kong is? I would not expect it to do as well in theaters. It might be one that does better on HBO Max. Who knows? We'll see what happens in May. The next one I want to hit is another Warner Brothers movie, and that is Space Jam, A New Legacy, in theaters and on HBO Max, July 16th.
Welcome to the space.
Welcome, King James. I am the king of this domain.
This is the Serververse.
What'd you do to my son? Where's Dom?
The only way you're getting your son back is if you and I play a little basketball.
I'm a cartoon?
Meh. What's up, Doc?
I need to assemble an elite team to help get my son back.
I know what you're looking for. A dream team.
Welcome to the Space Jam.
You know what? I was not a big fan of the first Space Jam, mainly because I don't care about basketball. I mean, I saw it years ago. I'm probably going to rewatch it again because it is on HBO Max. But I got to say this, the LeBron James in this movie, it actually looks kind of cool. This actually intrigued me just in sort of the Tron-esque version of bringing LeBron James into this hyper-real world. So this one kind of caught my eye. I like the trailer better than I like the first Space Jam. So who knows? Maybe this one will actually be pretty good. Anyways, that's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Power and Them. And And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews and talk about one on Shudder. Again, happy halfway to Halloween, people. And that is The Power. In 1974, a young woman gets a job as a nurse in London during rolling blackouts and faces mysterious demons when the lights go out.
We have to move nearly all the patients out because of the cut tonight. You will stay on.
The dark shift.
Does the dark bother you?
A place people die in should never be allowed to get that dark.
Are you scared of something?
Who did that? Something chased me into the basement. When I looked, there was no one there.
How much are you willing to give?
I have to admit, I'm very conflicted with this movie. On one hand, I really like the fact this takes itself seriously. I think it's an interesting location. I'm a bit of a sucker for movies that take place in hospitals and psych wards. For some reason, that appeals to me as a horror movie watcher. And there's some interesting stuff that goes on in this. There are some downsides I found. I watch a lot of British programming, so I'm pretty good at hearing the accents. You know, sometimes you watch a movie and that the accents are so thick they're hard to understand. Like you watch something like Trainspotting. If you're not used to listening to Scottish accents, it's kind of hard to understand sometimes. So I'm pretty good at chewing through the accent. That doesn't bother me. That doesn't really faze me. Although I gotta say, I had trouble with the dialogue in this movie. I was watching a screener, so I didn't have subtitles. But people, like, they mumble through a lot of their dialogue in here, and I think that's because they're trying to kind of underplay a lot of things. Like, the main character is this nurse, but she's scared, and she's having, like, flashbacks and visions, and things are haunting her, and she's physically getting assaulted by the ghosts, and so she's, at times, plays the character very meek. And at times, I have trouble hearing what she's saying. And I think part of it's also the way they're shooting the movie, and I get part of it because it's about darkness, and it's about these rolling blackouts that went on in London in the 70s, and they have to shut down wings of the hospital because you can't have people plugged in when the lights go off. They got to put them into a room that has a proper generator. Even the daylight stuff, and even the stuff where they have lighting in the hospital is underlit. And honestly, I think from a creative standpoint, that's kind of a mistake. If you really wanted to show a dichotomy, you have it actually be intensely bright during the day and when they have lights on, so that when the lights go out, they go out. But this one, it just seems to be underlit throughout the whole movie. And I'm like, well, why are you even worried about when the lights go out? Because you don't even have proper lighting to begin with. So the other part of the movie is she's haunted and by these visions. And I'm getting a little tired of at least how I was perceiving this going through, where there's actual trauma somebody has experienced that is just manifesting as hauntings. You saw that in the movie His House, which was on Netflix, although I thought that was at least a unique way of doing it. But it's an overused, almost to a point of being a cliche now. And I felt that that was really the path this was going down. There's a certain mystery here, but I don't know. It's a murky movie. And as much as I like the setup and even sort of the sequence of events work, it's just kind of muddy to get through. And that's a shame because it's different and it's unique. It just seems like overly murky to me. And I didn't appreciate this. As much as I liked the setting and I thought the actors were good, I don't know. There was just something missing from it. So it might be better for other people. We'll check it, check it out if you've got Shudder. It's not a waste of time, but I am going to have to give it a rating of kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with another horror element film or series, actually, and that is Them on Amazon Prime. In 1953, a black family from North Carolina moves to suburban Los Angeles only to face resistance from the white residents as well as supernatural demons.
This is how it begins, with one family.
They came from someplace worse. We'll have to make this place worse.
What's worse than worse?
Heard them folks in Compton straight up evil, man.
There's something bad in this house. I don't like it.
We got our eyes on you.
this is another one that has horror elements to it. It's ultimately telling a human story, but it has these horror elements to it. And I'm not through with it. I've only watched about half of it. There's 10 episodes. I believe they've dumped all of them on Amazon Prime, which is rare. Usually Amazon Prime ekes them out once a week. But I think Amazon Prime's playing with a binge watch system, just as Netflix is starting to eke out episode by episode a week on a couple new programs coming up. But them is being dropped all at once. I don't know if this is, I will say for sure, it's definitely not good for binge watching because it's kind of exhausting in a lot of ways. But they have these elements to it that are horror. And I don't know how this all plays out for the end of the series, and I wouldn't tell you anyways because I don't want to spoil it. But there's parts of it that I'm like, I hope this just isn't some manifestation of guilt and trauma and grief. Because it's overdone. I've seen that a million times. To me, that's a level of it was all a dream kind of stuff. But if I gotta have horror, I want there to be actual legit horror going on and not just, you know, visions, you know. So the story of this follows this black family in 1953 that moves into this very white neighborhood. And they are not greeted warmly, let's say. The whole neighborhood comes out against them, and they're very aggressive about it. And, you know, there's a black family that moved in, and we got to get rid of them. They're going to make it problematic for them. And look, that stuff went on absolutely for sure. I remember my mom was telling me when my parents moved into their neighborhood, they thought there was a black family down the road, and my grandparents were concerned about that, which is that kind of world that it was in, you know, right around the, well, at the time they were moving, it was probably in the late 60s. But these are real things that people were concerned about. There's real, not just subversive, but overt racism in that. But this is, I mean, they play it so heavy. It's everybody in the neighborhood is ready to, they're not burning a cross on the front lawn because it's in California, but they're doing some horrible things. And there's like no, all the characters are horrible. Every single white person is a racist. The least racist person is like, should we set their house on fire? Maybe we shouldn't. Oh, I guess it's okay. So, I mean, even the least racist person is like, I'll just go along with it. It's fine. And I'm like, I don't know. That seems to be very heavy handed. But on the other hand, I'm wondering if they're presenting it so much from the family's point of view that that's really all they see. Because even if half the people are that bad and the other half aren't, you're really just going to see the bad stuff. It's frustrating and it's exhausting. The other thing is the way the family reacts to them, they make some poor choices in their reaction, which is understandable, but you still have to say, when you're doing that, you're playing right into the stereotype and all you're doing is reinforcing why they don't want you there. It's well made. And it sort of fits in that sort of Jordan Peele, let's talk about a race issue up front in a horror movie, but maybe it would have been better as a single movie, like a two and a half hour movie, because it drags it on throughout and it gets punishing at a certain point. Even though I have reservations about it, I still think it's a competently well-made show. It's worth seeing. I'm going to say them kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Voyagers and Thunder Force. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about Voyager. This is exclusively in theaters this weekend, and in the film, on a mission to colonize another planet, a ship full of genetically bred teenagers must learn to govern themselves and control their desires.
We are all alone.
It's the blue.
They're drugging us.
What does it feel like to feel something?
Increased pleasure.
Cares about the rules. We can do what we want.
Why have they all gone crazy?
Maybe this is our true nature.
That's a profound thought.
Like I said, this is exclusively in theaters, and it's directed by Neil Berger. And the reason I point that out is Neil Berger actually has a really good filmography. He's done some great movies in the past. I mean, he did The Illusionist. That's the one with Edward Norton. He was fantastic. That was a good movie. He did Limitless. That was a good movie. And he did The Upside, which I actually thought was a pretty decent adaptation of the French movie, The Untouchables, and it had Bryan Cranston and Kevin Hart in it. Berger also did Divergent. And the reason I point that out is this movie has a distinct Divergent feel to it, in the sense that it seems to really be aiming for that young adult fiction mentality. You know, stuff like Hunger Games, Twilight, and of course, Divergent, The Maze Runner. It's not the same subject matter where it's this dystopian society where they have to break off into sects. But the reason I say that is because it felt like it was written for that audience. The movie itself has some brilliant ideas to it, and it has some amazing concepts. From a speculative fiction setup, it's kind of fantastic. I mean, the gist of it is they genetically engineer these kids and keep them in a closed environment, so when they put them into space, they don't miss being outside. And they've lived their entire life in this very restricted situation. And then they're supposed to age on the spaceship because the spaceship's going to take like 80 years to get to the planet. They're going to colonize. And then they're supposed to breed and have kids. And then their grandkids, by the time they have grandkids, they're going to be able to reach the planet and then they can colonize the planet. That's the setup. Now, in the process of doing it, they sort of have to suppress some of the, let's just say, some of the more problematic things you're going to have with teenagers. They're taking a drug that basically inhibits their sexual desire and it makes them passive. But of course, at some point, somebody figures it out and then they stop taking it. And it breaks down into chaos. And they have one person to keep control of everybody. And that's Colin Farrell. They don't have multiple adults involved. And they don't even have like a AI computer that's supposed to keep them. So if something's going to happen to the adult, then it just leaves the kids to nothing. And in a way, it's, you know, it's juggling these same concepts that you had in a, you know, classic story like Lord of the Flies. And you have the groups of kids, you know, pairing off and figuring out, you know, one against the other. And they kind of have these two factions. Like I said, it follows that pattern of Lord of the Flies. That's why I've been referring to it as Star-Lord of the Flies or Piggies in Space. Because, of course, they don't have a Piggy character in this. Not as overt as Piggy was in Lord of the Flies. But, you know, I mean, ugly things happen. But it's very one-dimensionally written. With something like Lord of the Flies, was done at very many levels, and it had stuff to say about existing society and building a society and where the problems were and how to get started and control and leadership. And it squanders all that. This movie does. Now, if you watch the trailers are also terrible. Because the trailers basically look like a teen orgy in space. And that's not what it is. Now, I know they had to cut down some stuff from R to PG-13, but maybe they lost all the sexual desire stuff because it just, nothing really happens as much as you'd expect. You know, you put enough teenagers together, there's going to be some sex going on. And I honestly was done with this movie and I'm like, was there sex going on at all? Or did people just hold hands? I couldn't tell. So when the pseudo-society has the breaking down problems, it's the teenage version of a much more mature story like Lord of the Flies, only it's not done very well. You know, this one does not get a conch shell. it blows it. It just doesn't blow the conch shell. It blows the idea of actually having a good story. So ultimately, Voyagers was just very disappointing to me because I was expecting something bigger. I love these kind of traps. You know, like I always said, I like people trapped in a mental hospital. I love people trapped on a spaceship stories, and this one didn't quite cut the mustard, so to speak. So I'm going to have to say that Voyagers kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Thunder Force, which is not what happens to me after I eat Indian food. A pair of estranged friends from childhood take a serum which gives them superpowers and enables them to fight crime in the city.
I've been developing a genetic platform that will allow us to give ordinary people superpowers.
What's your superpower?
Invisibility.
That's awesome.
Let's see what these powers can really do.
Thunder Force, remember it.
For the first time in history, we're seeing real-life superheroes fighting crime. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But we're also seeing a new kind of criminal.
This city deserves what's coming.
This is exclusively on Netflix, and it's directed by Ben Falcone, who is Melissa McCarthy's husband. And he's directed her in many films before, going all the way back to Tammy, like in 2014. Now, in general, I've been a huge critic of Ben Falcone. I, in general, do not like his movies. I don't think he's a good director, but I think he's finally developing into a director. He knows what he's doing, and he's finally learning how to utilize his wife, and I think they're finally working together to get the best out of both of them, because he's almost exclusively directed Melissa McCarthy movies. So I think finally the nepotism's paying off. This is not a superhero movie, even though they're about superheroes. It's not a Marvel movie. It's one of these movies, and we've had a lot of these, some of them TV shows. We talked about Invincible a couple weeks ago. I talked about The Boys. It's not a superhero film, but it's like a deconstruction or an alternate type of superhero film. This is not meant to be the next Marvel movie. It's meant to sort of make fun of the genre, and it does so by being in the genre, and it rests squarely on the shoulders of Melissa McCarthy and Octavia Spencer. Now, I like Melissa McCarthy. I think she's very funny, and I think she can do drama quite well, but she's in her element with humor. You're not a big surprise with her. I think Octavia Spencer is a national treasure. I think she is one of the best actresses of her generation, and she has never really gotten a lot of chance to do different things because, you know, she got known for The Help, and she ends up playing very similar characters to that. I love the fact that you can take two women in their 40s who are, let's just say, their body shape's a little closer to mine, and give them a superhero movie. I think that's amazing because they're hilarious in it. And Octavia Spencer has this wicked wit, and she underplays it, and she has a great chemistry with Melissa McCarthy, and they play off each other really well. And they find the funny in this movie. I think part of it is Falcone just kind of lets them be hilarious, and they're both very good at this. And they've got a nice supporting cast. You got Bobby Cannavale as a corrupt politician. You got Pom Clemente. She plays Mantis in the Marvel movies. She plays a bad guy in this, or an evil superhero. Because the gist of the story is there's a radiation that only affects sociopaths and gives them superpowers. So these are the first good guys that have shown up, and they're fighting bad guys. It's got Jason Bateman in there in a great performance. He's worked with Melissa McCarthy before. I think this is sort of this perfect storm of these people working together, and I found it hilarious. I found myself laughing at it. I thought there was a lot of wit to it. I thought there were obvious jokes here and there, but they also didn't just make it about, I mean, they make jokes about their age and their body shape, but it's that's not always the punchline. And that's another thing with Melissa McCarthy movies, like that movie Identity Thief, everything was a punchline about her being overweight. And this one, sure, you get a couple of those in there, but there's plenty of other humor to mine from this. And I thought this was a hoot. I mean, it's not meant to be a massive movie, but if you want a good laugh, gosh, Thunder Force did it for me. I think it was hilarious. And it's 100% on the shoulders of Octavia Spencer and Melissa McCarthy. They're brilliant in it. So I'm going to have to say, I think Thunder Force totally rocked.
It rocks.
Excellent.
And that's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Last Cruise and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring News of the World. At the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews. Well, this really isn't a full movie, but I wanted to talk about it because there's some interesting things to say. This is a documentary that was on HBO, and I caught it on HBO Max. It's called The Last Cruise. I actually previewed it a couple weeks ago because I thought it was very relevant and something interesting to talk about. And in The Last Cruise, this HBO documentary uses firsthand footage of people on the Diamond Princess cruise ship during the initial coronavirus outbreak.
This is your captain speaking. Please be advised that two guests tested positive for coronavirus.
It was just all kind of hearsay. Like, oh, there's a virus. There's always something around the world going on. Still not a big deal. You're kind of like, okay, cool. I'll wash my hands.
Then the captain came on and told us to go back into our rooms.
The length of the quarantine will be at least 14 days.
There's a couple reasons why I chose to talk about this movie. One of it is because we are, and I wouldn't say we're certainly not at the end of the pandemic, but we can see a light at the end of the tunnel. That does not mean that we're not still in the tunnel. We still got some track to go, but we can see a light at the end of the tunnel. And it's nice to remember where we started with the pandemic. And while it started elsewhere, you know, we believe in Wuhan, China, and in Asia was where the first cases were discovered. And then I can't remember if there were any in the U.S. yet at the time. But what had happened was the Diamond Princess was a cruise ship that was in Japan and it had an outbreak on board. And the Japanese authorities would not let it dock, would not let people get off the cruise ship. And they quarantined the cruise ship. But the problem was, because the virus was so infectious and took some time to spread around, and it was mostly responsible for spreading in somewhat closed circulation environments, it became a super spreader. And somewhere by the end of the whole situation, like 700 cases ended up on this cruise ship, and like 24 people died. And what this does is, for the most part, it assembles footage that people shot themselves on their cell phone. And once they had to quarantine, you had several passengers who were sort of live blogging it. And they were like either videotaping it. I don't know if they were sending it out to people. And at some point, the crew, some people in the crew, because they felt that they were being treated poorly and they felt that they were not being kept healthy, they started taking video of themselves, and they assemble a lot of this. And it's really interesting because now we know so much more about this virus. We know generally how it spreads. We know what the incubation period is. We know it's definitely airborne, and we know what works and what doesn't. So it's a look back at when we were as a world in a stage of ignorance. Now, this documentary is only 40 minutes long, and it is very limited in scope. And I say that because while there's a couple things of the crew, the only passengers that really get any sort of service are these passengers that were, there's not like first class, but they were in suites. So they had balconies and, you know, I've been on quite a few cruise ships and most rooms are on the inside and most rooms are about the size of your average bathroom. If you want to talk about size of being able to move around. They don't have video from those people. Now, maybe part of it was because they wanted it to be an English language documentary, and a great majority of people on that cruise ship were Asian. They're Japanese or Chinese or Korean or something like that, and they maybe weren't ready to share that. But they had all these Americans and taking video of themselves. But you see the disparity between the people on the balconies who can have fresh air going, oh, my eggs are cold and I don't like eating cold eggs, to the people in steerage, this crew crammed in there and infecting each other. But it's a real interesting look at the pandemic when we didn't know anything about it. Now, the crazy thing for me is I was actually on a cruise during this because I knew about the ship, but it was in a totally different hemisphere. It was on the other side of the world. And my wife and I and our son took a cruise, got on a ship, and, you know, we went out into the Bahamas. And when we came back, they still hadn't come home from the Diamond Princess. So, I mean, we were watching this, and we were watching on a cruise ship thinking what would happen if it happened to us, because we had an interior stateroom. Now, fortunately for us, nothing bad happened. And we got off the ship and drove home, and everything was cool. But it really put it in perspective now, knowing what we know about the disease and the dangers of that disease, potential risks that we had. So I think it's worth watching now with so much more public knowledge of the science behind this and what were fears. Like there's a scene in there where they're like, they were afraid that the Japanese were just going to blow up the ship. There was actually rumors that that's what the Japanese government was going to do, just blow up the ship and let it sink. I mean, I don't think they were, but you can imagine the worry that went on the ship for the month that they were not at sea, but just in this cove in Japan. So I'm going to say it's not a perfect documentary. It has some gaping holes in it, but it's interesting to watch, especially if you did any sort of traveling around that time. So I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. I'm a couple weeks late on this one, but I wanted to cover it. And that is News of the World, which came out this Christmas. It just came out on Blu-ray and DVD, so you got the physical media. I think it came out 2 weeks ago. But in the News of the World, Tom Hanks stars as a Civil War veteran who is put in charge of bringing a young girl who's lived with Native Americans most of her life back to a settler's home.
It says your name is Johanna Leonberger. Indians took you when they attacked your family 6 years prior. Your mother, father, and sister were... well, they passed. She's got family down in Castroville.
Captain, why are you doing this?
She needs to laugh and dream. She needs new memories.
The movie itself is a beautiful film. And it's kind of a shame that it got lost for award season. Because it's a great performance by Tom Hanks. But it's also not a award-winning performance. It's not the kind of performance that everybody took notice of. And he wouldn't win anyways because I pretty much think Chadwick Boseman for Ma Rainey's Black Bottom has that shown up. But this is a great performance by Tom Hanks because he does it with such gravitas. He does it with such somber control. And he plays this wise man who is living his life the best he can in some very ugly situations. Plus the little girl in it, who Hannah, and I forget her last name, she's brilliant in it. She's actually really, really good, you know, playing this girl who doesn't even speak English because she speaks Kiowa, which is the Native American tribe that she was living with. It's also a brilliant movie from Paul Greengrass, who's best known for very frenetic use of camera work. If you remember, I mean, he did United 93, which is all handheld, and he also did the Bourne movies, and a lot of people complain about his stuff because it is almost too jarring, and he did that movie Green Zone with Matt Damon. I remember that one was probably too much moving around, like, it didn't need to be that much frenetic movement, and he did that with, like, Captain Phillips, but this is a Western, so it has these broad, long shots, these wide helicopter shots, and these beautiful landscapes of the Western United States, and you don't want to handshake those. You want those to be nice and steady, and, you know, you want that John Ford Western look to it. It's one of those that's an anti-Western in a lot of ways. I mean, it has all the elements. And then the behind the scenes, I'll talk about it in a minute. Greengrass talks about saying, oh, I have the gunfight. I have this scene. You have all the stuff that you get in a Western movie, but it reluctantly does that. This is not a Sergio Leone film. Even this isn't even one of those Clint Eastwood deconstructing the genre movies. It's a classic Western, but an anti-Western, kind of maybe the way Unforgiven would be, if you want to put a Clint Eastwood spin to this. But it's a well-done movie. It's beautifully done. It's forgotten. I think a lot of people missed it, but so it is absolutely worth hunting down. Now, the Blu-ray has some bonus features to it, about 10 minutes of deleted scenes, and then I think it has about 4 behind-the-scenes videos. Like they talk about Tom Hanks and the girl, and they talk about it, you know, putting the Western angle to it. You've got a spotlight on Paul Greengrass, and probably the most interesting part I found was a spotlight on the Kiowa, the Native American tribe that is featured in this movie, and they used real Kiowa in this, and what their culture means, and how they filtered that into the movie as well. And of course, there's a feature commentary. So it has some decent special features, but the reason to see it is for the movie. It's a good movie, and I really think it kind of just got lost in the dust this Christmas, which is a shame, because it was absolutely worth seeing. And if you didn't see it until now, now is your chance. It's on home video. It totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
Also available this week are Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar, The Reckoning, Shadow in the Clouds, and Earwig and the Witch. And that's it. I gotta go. Next week, I'm gonna be talking about Vanquish and The Rookies. And until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.